Hey everybody, let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the Nava Club. We're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight, listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this. I've gotten to know Glenn, who's our speaker tonight, pretty good. We're together most Saturday mornings at a meeting at 7:30. Our speaker last week, that's her home group also, and it was a coincidence that we got two back-to-back fresh air speakers, but we definitely got great sobriety up there. Glenn's an excellent example of that. I really appreciate him taking time out of his busy schedule. Thanks for coming and doing the deal.
Thank you, Tim.
Glenn S.
Hi, my name is Glenn Smith, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Tim, thanks for inviting me to come up here. It helps a tremendous deal to talk about the past, what happened, and what it's like now. That's what it's all about. My sobriety date is January the 4th of 2007, so I just celebrated 10 years. Life is immeasurably better than it was, because I was really a dead man walking at that point. I guess the best way is just to go back and start when I first had a drink. I was born and raised in Atlanta, right over by Chastain Park. I can't say anything about my childhood except good things. Great parents, love in the household. I never heard my dad raise his voice to my mom. I'm sure he did to me, and I deserved it, but you know, we just basically, it was the Cleavers. I mean, we had great grandparents always involved. My parents to this day always tell us they love us at anytime we see them. Everything was really special. There was alcohol in the house, but it was never really abused that I can remember. I've never seen my mom drunk, and maybe I've seen my dad have a few too many back in the day, but there was never anything in that household that would influence me to get to the place I went. Going through high school, like anybody else, I probably started drinking when I was 15 or 16, stole liquor out of the cabinet just because it was cool. It was just like what everybody did. You find beer, and as you get older, up into your teens, it was drugs, sex, and rock and roll. I mean, we wanted to listen to music. We wanted to chase girls, and it was just, that's just basically what you did. I would say that from an early time on, I liked it as much as anybody. I liked getting drunk. It wasn't out of hand at that point, and we were still like in high school, but as I went off to college, where it became more prevalent, and even though the drinking wasn't every day, over those 4 years, and I met some of my greatest friends to this day, but I was introduced to pot pretty much in college. My name was around in high school, but I wasn't interested, and by the time I got to college and I got involved in that too, I was pretty much a pothead for about 17 years along with the booze. But, you know, going back to college, and we worked hard, but we played harder. We did what we had to do to get by. But I would say that in any given party, if I wasn't the drunkest or most messed up person there, I deserved honorable mention. I mean, I was always out there. But that was, it seemed harmless at that time. I mean, that was just it seemed like everybody else was doing. I mean, we were just, if you're going to parties, you're going to get drunk, and you're going to do any drugs that came across. I mean, if it was there, I was not afraid of it. getting through that 4 years, and then a lot of different friends would, you know, go off and were going to get jobs, and no, I wanted to go out west. I wasn't done. So I met up with a buddy and went out west for that summer, and it was just, you know, it was the endless road trip to California. And the partying didn't stop, but at that point it just still seemed like it was just, we're just having fun. I mean, that was, and we were. I mean, I look back on that time actually fondly, even though we were behaving like idiots and I was planting the seeds for what was going to come decades later. But you know, after about a year and a half in California, once I got there, and then I called my parents and said, well, I'm going to come back to Atlanta. But I said, on the way, I'm going to stop in the Rockies because some other friends are living out there, and I'm going to stop and go fly fishing for a couple of weeks, and then I'm going to come on back to Atlanta. And so I stopped there, and I stayed 2.5 more years. And I was working in a restaurant out there that was, it was not only the place that I worked, but it was also the place that everybody hung out, and it was the place that really, the serious problems started to develop. There were drugs. There was, it was a constant. I mean, there was drinking on the job if you chose to. But once again, it was just fun. I was 23, 24, 25 years old, just having the time of my life. And actually, after a couple of years there, even by my standards, I'd had enough. And that was actually the first time when I was out there in Colorado that I went to an AA meeting, because I started to cave. Things started to go, I was losing control, and I would go, you know, weeks at a time without slowing down, and I went to my boss at the time and said, I need help, I need to stop living like this. And so I went and talked to a therapist, I think they sent me to, and then a couple of friends took me to AA, and that was my first experience with it. Well, I think I went to two meetings, and everything we talked about today, I was young, and I was just, you know, they were talking about God, and I saw all these people that were happy to be there, and I wasn't. But I ended up surprisingly staying sober for like 5 months. I mean, I just was thinking, okay, it's summer, and I'm out here in the Rockies, and I'm going to work out, and I'm going to get in shape. Well, that was great, and then the next winter came around, and I got right back into the same old habits, and a couple of months later, I finally did. I left and came on back to Atlanta. moved in with some good friends from high school and college, and the drinking continued, but there, you know, none of the other extracurricular stuff was around. But over that same period, over about the next year and a half, and this is now into the early 90s, 90 or 91, I got two DUIs within about 7 months. Pled no load to the first one, and the second one I kind of weaseled out of. It cost me a lot of money, but it never occurred to me that I had an alcohol problem. You get two DUIs in 7 months. Maybe the problem was me, but it never even, that didn't slow me down a bit. It was like, I'm just not being careful. The first one I ran a red light, and the second one I had a taillight out, and I just thought, you're just dumb. You did stupid things. Never, you shouldn't have been drinking and driving, or you shouldn't have been in that situation in the first place. So, you know, I had a good job in Atlanta working for a restaurant company, and had a career change. And at that time, I met my future wife, and we fell in love, and it was a whirlwind courtship after really just a couple of months. And I had a career change and a job offering in Orlando, Florida. So, two of us, having known each other for literally, we had mutual friends going back since high school days, but after about 2.5 months, we up and packed up a U-Haul, and she quit her job, and we moved to Orlando, Florida. And if you've never done something like that, and you've never even shared a bathroom with somebody you hadn't known for 2 months, you get to know somebody really quickly. And fortunately, it was wonderful. It worked. And we had a great 3 years down in Florida together. You know, the drinking continued, but it was controlled. You know, she would say now probably that she was an enabler even from the beginning, and I just say, no, that's not true. There's nothing anybody in that situation can do. You know, anything you're going to try, I was going to shut it down, and that went on for, gosh, 15 more years. But we ended up, we had a great time in Orlando. I ended up getting a job and moving back to Atlanta to work for our family business. And so we moved back here in 95. And at some point during that, slowly but surely, I mean, it's cunning, baffling, powerful. Everything we talk about in here is all true because, you know, we weren't going out to bars and we weren't going out to drink. But at some point in that transition is when I started buying the Jägermeister bottle and putting it in my own freezer, or buying a big handle of bourbon and having all the liquor that I needed right in the house, where if I get home from work, we don't have to go out to a bar. I'm just not going to grab a beer. I'm going to go get a tumbler and just start pouring straight liquor and chasing it or whatever. I can't even say it crept up on me. It was just boom. It was just there. And that started mid-90s all the way up to 98. We were back here in Atlanta, and our twin daughters were born in 98. And I remember the night they were born, they were preemies. And they were almost 8 weeks early, less than 3 pounds at birth. And my wife's water broke at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I passed out drunk at about 10:30. And she had to wake me up in a stupor to drive to Northside Hospital for my kids to be born. And I was drunk. I can't get those back. You know, you can't. But you know what? Looking back on it, and that was, they're almost 19 years old. Back then, I didn't give it a second thought. I felt guilty about it for about 5 minutes. It was just, that's fine, you know. Everything's going to be great. Well, girls were born. We ended up moving out to Alpharetta. We're happy family. Everything's fine. Drinking did not slow down one bit once my kids were born. I mean, you got little kids, little preemies with heart monitors on them around the house, and I was drinking every day. Just never slowed down. We ended up moving out to Alpharetta, and I was commuting back and forth into Buckhead every day to work. Some point along the way, you know, got to where I'd sometimes stop and pick up beer on the way home just to drive that hour through that traffic. Well, I'm just sitting in, I'm parked on 400 anyway. There's a difference does it make if I'm drinking a beer? It's just the whole pickled thinking. And you know, I think back, that was 20 years ago almost. anyway, back in 03, moved forward, and the girls are, they're now in preschool. And I had a job offer to move to Alabama, to Decatur, Alabama. And so it was a good opportunity for me at the time. So we packed up the girls in preschool and left the grandparents and left everybody and moved to Alabama, where we, again, didn't know anybody. But I had a good job, and it was a cost of living is very inexpensive over there. And it was a great place to raise kids. We really enjoyed being there. But I, once again, the drinking, I brought it with me. It continued to escalate. If I can, you know, I'm just trying to fast forward through times. Over that period of from 03 to about 05, I started to embarrass myself publicly. I'd get, you know, we'd be at parties and I'd be, you know, it's one thing if you're in college and you're the drunkest person there, but when you're 40 years old or close to it and you're staggering around a cocktail party where nobody else has had but like one glass of wine, you're just making an ass of yourself. And I did that repeatedly to the point that my wife, you know, obviously she had requested multiple times, you know, please will you talk to somebody, please will you try to stop, this is affecting our marriage, this is affecting the girls, this is, you know, the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde thing, I don't know who's going to come out once you start drinking. And I just completely blew it off. I mean, I remember having a marriage counselor that we had calls with and met with, and she would flat out ask me and say, you know, she's asking you about your drinking. And I would say, well, that's fine, but there's no way I'm going to stop drinking. I'm just defiant about it. And I look back on those things again and can't get that back. So over those couple of years, and this is like 2005 or so, finally, for all the right reasons, and God bless her, my wife had enough. And she said, we're done. I'm out. I can't live with you anymore. I don't love you anymore. You're hurting yourself. You're hurting me. You're hurting your friends. You know, you name it. And this is just not working. You know, I don't want to be married to you anymore. And, you know, at the time it was very upsetting, and having to tell your basically first grade kids that you're getting a divorce, they understand that. And at the same time, it was emotional for all of us, but you know what? I didn't care. I really didn't. I just thought, to hell with it. I'm going to get a place of my own, and I can do what the heck I want to do. I was actually kind of excited about it. So we were at that point when you started thinking, okay, I'm going to have to get an apartment. We sold the house, bought them another house. We had no money. I mean, I had a good job, but we had no money because I'm a drunk and I piss everything away. That's just what I do. So I go off living by myself, and over the course of the next, from somewhere around 05 till 07, those 2 years were where I really became, went from amateur status to a real professional drunk. And I should have mentioned too, those last couple of years, even when we were married and together, that's also when I was hiding liquor. I mean, I wear boots to work every day, and I have for 2 decades, and a half pint fits really snugly right in either side of these boots when you walk in the house, and you got a half pint in each boot along with booze hidden around the house. I mean, I had every conceivable way to hide it so that I could get away with it. But once I lived alone, I became completely paranoid. I mean, I was drinking all the time. I'm living alone, but I would still think, and nobody ever came over because nobody knew where I was or nobody cared. I mean, I go to work, and I was still working really hard, but I was drinking harder. And I was hiding liquor in my own apartment. I would get a gallon bottles of vodka and pour it into water bottles and pitch the liquor bottles and mark the water bottle and have them like under the bed or in the, I mean, just, I can't even rationalize how I did that or why. But now, granted, I've always had one in my desk at work. I would still go pick my girls up and take them to the bus every morning when they weren't staying with me, which was becoming more and less frequent than ever. Because there were several times when I would have the girls and my wife would call and I wouldn't answer the phone. And I mean, honestly, she would call on a weekend I'm supposed to have, and she'd come over, and I'd be just passed out on the couch. Girls are running around my den in my apartment, and she'd just take them. Rightfully, she should have. You know, looking back on it, to me, I guess it was as bad as it gets. But I still didn't see that I had, you know, I knew I had a problem, but I wasn't doing anything about it. And I wanted everybody to leave me alone, and I wasn't being included. I'd hear about weddings, or I'd hear about hunting weekends with all my buddies that I'd known since forever, and I wasn't included. Nobody invited me. And then the defiance kicks in, like, assholes. They didn't want me to come. What's their problem? Well, they didn't want me around. It's reality. And I don't blame them. So, came to the fall of 2006, and over the course of those few months, things really started to spiral. It's a progressively deadly disease, and I couldn't stop, and I knew I couldn't stop. And we got around to Christmas and New Year's that year, and I need to rewind and go back to that. That fall, that August, was also my 40th birthday, and this is another thing that I'll regret to this day. But I remember I came into Atlanta and went to dinner, to a nice dinner with my parents. And, we were going to go to dinner. I was staying in town. They offered to stay with us. Oh, no, I wanted to stay in a hotel because I wanted to drink and do what I wanted to do. I didn't even want to be at their house and spend the night because I couldn't get away with what I knew was wrong. So we went to dinner, and I showed up at dinner and I was drunk. And I remember my mom sitting there at my 40th birthday dinner, and she's crying. And all I wanted to do was get out of there. I just wanted to get out of there and go back to the bar. You know, I can't reconcile that. But anyway, fast forward to that, to around Christmas of that year, and everything was just falling apart. And at that time, my body was my midsection was distended, and I could. It's so strange, and I'm sure other people, when I've talked about it before, have felt the same thing. But it's almost like I could feel my organs working. I could feel cramps, and it wasn't like a muscle cramp. It was things were not good. It was not healthy, and I really thought. I had a friend that a couple of months earlier that I'd known since high school who passed away of addiction, evidently laying on the couch with a remote control in his hand. And I kept thinking on that, and I thought, you know, so at the very end, didn't matter who I'd hurt before or what I had done or anything, I was so freaking selfish, I was just worried about my own death. I was worried, I just didn't want to die. And that was, and so that was finally what kicked it in. I wasn't thinking about anybody but myself, even to the very end. But I got drunk again one night, and I thought I called some different friends that I'd grown up with that were in the program that were sober for years, and they kept telling me, "Dude, you know, you just need to, I mean, we don't know what to tell you. We're there for you, but you need to go to AA. You need to go." So I went to this meeting. It was about at an 8 o'clock at night meeting. Drunk, I couldn't hardly stand up when I walked in there, and these two guys were like, "Hey, buddy, why don't you?" They ushered me back into the Al-Anon room, and these two really kind people sat there and told me they wanted to help me, and I sat there and told them I was different, and they didn't know what they were talking about, and you know, I'm sort of thinking, "You're the one that came here, you know, you're obviously looking for something," but anyway, they ended up driving me home, and they said, they said they wanted to drive me home, and of course I refused, but I only lived like, ironically, my apartment was like literally a block and a half from an AA hall. And there was God speaking to me. I just didn't know about the future. But anyway, they followed me home, and I went inside that night, and that was January 4th, 2007. And I don't know what it was. I don't know why then, but I started crying. I was just, I was so miserable. My life was completely falling apart. And I knew, I don't know, something just clicked. This is all your damn fault. Everything you've done is your own fault. Please. And I was telling myself, just get help, just get help. So I went to the fridge and I just pulled the beer out, pulled every bit of liquor I could possibly have and just dumped it down the sink. And, I sat there all night crying, and about 5 o'clock in the morning, I got on the phone and called my wife. My wife and I had never gotten divorced because we couldn't afford divorce. We'd been separated for 2 years, living completely separate lives, except for trying to jointly raise our kids or trying to, because my addictions wouldn't really let me do what I needed to do. That's a horrible thing to say. It was all me. I'm blaming it on an addiction. It's not. It's my fault. Anyway, I called my family. I called my boss. I called anybody that would listen to me at 5 o'clock in the morning. I called my brother, who's here tonight, who was kind enough to drive all the way from Atlanta to Decatur, Alabama, to pick my sorry ass up and take me to a rehab place in Nashville, Tennessee, which is exactly where I needed to be. Another friend had helped me. So that was how I got there. I was in a completely desperate state. I knew nothing. I had no spiritual life. I had no social life anymore. I had no loving. I had so many people that loved and cared about me that I pushed away. And all because I wanted, it was my agenda. You know, when we talk about it being a disease of self, I was completely self-absorbed in it and had been for really 20 years, if I'm honest about it. So I was in rehab, and like anybody else, put me in detox. They were surprised when I got there because they, by the next afternoon, and they checked me out, gave me the test. They said, "You're not drunk. Everybody that comes in here is drunk." And I was like, "No, I'm not, but I'm in the right place." And, 2 days in, I woke up and thought, "Oh my gosh, what have I done?" But at the same time, I needed that padded room. I needed to be away. And I knew, even looking back on, as much as AA has helped save my life, at that stage, I needed to go away. So, went to rehab and came out. 30 days, obviously like anything else, this, alcoholism, you can take somebody the worst off and give them a week without booze, and you feel a lot better. I mean, you just physically, I was just like, man, I feel like $1 million. But knowing there was strangely enough, there was a finality to it. I don't know if it was something about finally just coming out and saying it to my family and friends that I'm an alcoholic and an addict and I need help. I wasn't craving it. Even when I came out of rehab, you know, I've heard people, many people say, that's the first thing they think is, I just want to go hit a liquor store. I didn't. The thought of that was just, no, I really don't want to do that. So, like they told us for the first, you know, the first 90 days, I bet I went to 150 meetings. I mean, if I wasn't at work, I was going to AA meetings. But about those first 2 months, I was absolutely miserable. I was not, you know, we'd read the big book at rehab, but I was going to all these meetings, but I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't know anything about the steps. I wasn't doing anything that I was supposed to do except showing up to meetings. And relationships were not restored. And, you know, I'd read the steps and all I thought was, nice step. I need to go tell everybody how sorry I am. I mean, and I tried that a few times and it was not well received. And it was all about, you know, but I promise I'm not going to, you know. I was absolutely miserable. I mean, I felt in my mind that I was worse off than I was when I was drinking. So like I said, I couldn't sleep at night. I went and saw two different shrinks, thinking they were going to find the answers, not, you know, having no idea that all the answers I needed were right there in the big book in front of me. All I had to do was follow these simple suggestions, but you couldn't have told me that at that time. Like I said, I've lived right near the AA hall, and I couldn't sleep at night, and I was still having the drinking dreams. But vivid. I mean, because for those last few years, the dreams were just awful. I mean, people that aren't alcoholics don't understand, you know, when you think about if you're a fan of, if you have hobbies, then you dream about those hobbies. But I dreamed about drinking. I mean, it was just vivid. I would wake up and anything I was doing had a bottle in it, and it was in it, and I'd wake up in like cold sweats. So the Stairway Group, in Decatur, Alabama, has a 5:30 a.m. meeting every morning of the week. And I'm an early riser, and plus at that time I wasn't sleeping anyway, so I was like 5:30 in the morning, I'm going to go to a meeting. Well, this group was four or five old-timers. I mean, guys with, you know, minimum 15 years sobriety up to about 40. And for several weeks I would go, and you're in a small table, there's not that many people there, and I'd sit on the other side of the room and wouldn't say anything, just keep my head down, but I was kept thinking, I'm there, I'm in a meeting. But these very kind gentlemen that were there over the period of time, including my future sponsor, Eddie, you know, after a while they'd be like, Glenn, why don't you come over here and join us? Why don't you come over here? We'd love to, you know, hear what you might have to say. And, you know, over time, I'd slowly would come over to their table, and of course it took several weeks, but slowly I started to listen to what they had to say. And you know, I was still miserable. It wasn't because I wasn't drinking, it was just because I thought if I just quit drinking, everything's going to be great, you know. And it just wasn't. I mean, life was still there, and I was still broke, and I was still divorced and living in this crappy apartment, and I felt like everybody owed me something, but I wanted to make, you know, if I want everybody to forgive me for all these things that I'd done. I was really textbook. But over time, and this really took about 3 months, but I finally was whining one day to one of my best friends who had helped me get me into treatment, and, you know, I was like, well, this isn't right, and he's like, Glenn, you dumbass, do you have a sponsor yet? I was like, no. He was like, well, then you know what you need to do? You just need to go get drunk. You need to go. You are not done yet. You need to go get hammered. You need to go. I think you just need to go buy a case of booze and go hold up in your apartment. And I got mad at him. I was like, what the hell are you talking about? That's crazy. He goes, you just are not with the program, Glenn. You're not doing anything you're supposed to be doing. You don't have a sponsor. You're not praying. You're not reading the big book. You're not. Yeah, you're going to meetings. So what? Listen to you. Listen to yourself. And he was absolutely right. Well, so sure enough, the next morning, I asked Eddie to be my sponsor. And went another about 3 weeks, and I felt so good about myself, I called my buddy and said, I have a sponsor now. He was like, He's like, so what? That's it. You gotta keep the ball rolling. You know, you're so proud of yourself because you asked somebody who doesn't even know anything about you yet to be your sponsor. But anyway, Eddie was one. He is one of the kindest people I've ever known because he was very patient, and he would say, "Glenn, you know, why don't you come on over to my house and let's read through the big book. We need to start step one." And I'd say, okay. So over the next few weeks, we got to step four, and then roadblock, of course, like anybody else. I put that one off for actually not as long as you would think, about a month. And he would kindly ask me, you know, and during this time, he was really taking the time. Even after that morning meeting, I was still going every morning at 5:30. It became a habit. It was like I really enjoyed it. I felt like I started to feel a part of something, and you know, slowly but surely, things started to change. I don't even know how to explain it. It's that once we did the four step together, and I started doing a real introspection about not just who I'd hurt, but why. It wasn't just listing those people that I'd hurt. It was thinking why. Well, because you're a selfish son of a bitch. I mean, it comes right down to that. You know, over the years, when people have asked me, that think they might have a problem with alcohol. And one thing, anything that I tell somebody else about alcoholism or AA or anything that they're asking, I don't have a single original thought on it. There's nothing I know that I haven't heard from you people in these rooms or my sponsor. That's it. Or read in the big book. It's, you know, I don't have an original thought on anything to do with addiction. But and somebody had told me this before years, when we talk about the chemical addiction of alcohol, and yes, towards the end, I was shaking so bad all the time that I had to drink vodka so that I could hold my hand steady enough to pour that half gallon of vodka into a water bottle, because that's a little hole, you know, but I couldn't do it. So the chemical addiction was there, but when people ask me about their problem with alcohol, and I say, well, let me ask you a question, because it was asked of me before. You know, yes, you develop a chemical addiction, but it's a disease of self, first and foremost. And I ask people, I say, have you ever had a time in your drinking life when a family member or a friend or anybody that cares about you has come and said, hey, you know what, I'm concerned. You know, I think you're drinking or partying too much, and it's unsettling to me, and I don't think it's healthy. Whatever they say, they're telling you they love you, and they think you might have a problem and you want to do something about it. If that's ever happened to you and you blew it off, that's the disease of self right there. And I had it full-fledged. I mean, I you know, because that happened to me many times over the years. So long before I had the serious chemical addiction, it was all about me. And I had to realize that when I did the four step, and that all these things that I'd done, and you know, I wasn't a violent drunk, but, you know, unintentionally, you know, hurt people emotionally, just not caring about what they thought. And, you know, my kids, I can't tell you how many times I drove them to the school bus drunk. I mean, little preschoolers. And I did it. And I justified it. Or I didn't think anything of it at the time. But, I mean, I don't know. I look back on it now and, you know, it makes me cringe, but at the same time, you know, it is what it is. Fortunately, having worked the steps through my sponsor and over the period of the next year or so, life changed. I mean, things got better through marriage counseling, but even after being separated for a couple of years, my wife and I, due to the fact that I could be reasoned with, and I started to learn just from, you know, there's nothing. I would whine to my sponsor about different things with marriage, and he would say, you know, there's a chapter in there, the family after Glenn. He said, I'm not a marriage counselor, but we can read that book. I mean, he was very clear about the fact that he was not going to give me any advice about that. But sure enough, we were able to work things out. Which is a success story that I'm lucky in that regard. It took a lot of communication. It took a lot of sacrifice on her part to give me another chance. But I can say today she's my best friend. We communicate. You know, it's been, you know, we've been back together, gosh, 9 years. It took about a year of work for that, for, you know, for us to really reconcile. But it's an amazing thing. You know, I'll look back, you know, what is life like now? This program's taught me everything about how to live life, how to be happy with what I have, how to accept things, what it's like to help other people. You know, it's taught me patience. It's taught me communication. It's taught me how to love again and to not think that I am totally in control. I had a really hard time early on. I'm not a really particularly religious person at all. So the whole God thing, like so many other people, it really kind of, you know, I was hesitant about that, about, you know, letting go and letting God, you know, always thinking, well, they're just preaching Jesus to me. And what I had other really wise, thoughtful people, you know, say, well, Glenn, would, let's look at it this way. When you were consumed with alcohol, when you were in the depths of alcohol, of active alcoholism, would you say that that alcohol was more powerful than you? It's like, absolutely. Of course it was. Well, you don't do that anymore. Well, no. And they say, well, then there's something out there more powerful than alcohol. Do you? I was like, that makes sense. Sure. Why don't you, whatever that is, it's God. Think about it that way. And that made perfect sense to me. I was like, you absolutely, I'd be dead now. I remember all I love AA. I remember all the cliches. I'll forget things, and then somebody will bring something up, you know, a year after I've heard it. I just heard the other day the whole, you know, pour me, pour me, pour me another drink. I mean, that one always just, I just crack up at that one. But there's so many little phrases that that just catch me with this program and have really changed my life. Actually, 4.5 years into sobriety, 5 years into sobriety, I had another event happen. We were still living in Alabama, and we had reconciled, and things were going really well. And I had I actually had an interview for a job back here in Georgia, and up in Gainesville, where we live now. And I remember talking to my sponsor. I'd not had an interview with any other company since then, but I thought, I'm going over to meet these guys, and I'm going to go, you know, talk to these, you know, senior management of this company. And I need to tell them I'm an alcoholic. And he said, well, that's a personal decision. Some people want to keep it very private. It's nobody's business. But I thought, I need to do that. I mean, and so when I went to that interview that day, and I met with all these guys individually, different meetings, and you know, I sat there and looked in all their eyes, and when they did the usual, well, you're looking at the resume and saying, oh, Glenn, tell us about yourself. And I said, well, you need to know that I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic, which they told me later they'd never had anybody say that to them in a job interview. And honestly, had I been 6 months sober, I never would have done that. But as it turned out, it was the right thing for me to do at the time, because I just told them, look, if I'm lucky enough to get this job and it's a couple years down the road or next week and we're, you know, at dinner and I order a glass of wine, or playing golf and I order a beer, or whatever it is we're doing, that is a red flag you need to know about if I'm going to be your employee. And if that happens, I need to either be fired immediately or send me back to rehab. And they said, point taken. Thanks for your transparency. And I got the job. So, you know, good things like that happen. And that's not to say that life is perfect. It's not to say that everything's always going to turn out the way I want it to, because it doesn't. But you know what? I'm happy today. I am genuinely a happy person. I can still do this, listen to the same loud music as I did before. I can still go fishing. I can go hunting. I can do all the stuff that I love to do and be around my friends. My nickname is Bloober, Glenn Uber, because I can drive people around if they want to do crazy stuff. I mean, I can leave and come and go as I please. You know, it's freedom is what it is. It's just the most amazing gift. And I wouldn't know anything about living sober except for what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. It is, you know, it helped get me to treatment, helped me sober up. But what it did most of all is it taught me about having a relationship with a power greater than myself, with God. That's why my God has no gender. or religious affiliation, but it is a being that saved my life. He keeps my family happy and me happy. I'm just grateful. That's really it. That's all I got. So I appreciate it.
Okay. I'm happy, joyous, and free after that. Who's going to take a drink tonight? Don't raise your hand. Who's going to stay sober tonight? Okay. Remember to say your prayers. It might help. Okay, Jim T., would you please come up and give out the chips?
Sure.
They're lined up, right?
I'm Jim. I'm an alcoholic. Amen. Here we hand out chips to mark our time in sobriety. And first chip we offer is the white chip. It's a sign that we don't want to drink the next 24 hours. Come on up.
Morning. He ain't scared of the dark. He doesn't gotta worry. But when it's all said and done, he ain't even started. But he's all ready done. Now it's paging Mr. Bitter. Party of one. He sees no reason to lie to you. Get him full of liquor, no telling what he'll do. Now it's all gone away, but he keeps moving from moon to sun. Now it's paging Mr. Bitter. Party of one. All around him, he ain't even got a home. He ain't got nobody, no one to call his own. He's older but not wiser. No one's fault but his own. So it's paging Mr. Bitter. party of one. Now it's paging Mr. Bitter. Party of one.